Thank you, Tim, for that great talk. Now we're going to open the floor to questions from both in person and online. I request that you state your name and organization before asking a question, and we'll sort of alternate between in person and online. And so with that, questions.
Kurt Weller, USAID. My question is, what's the difference in incidence of peanut allergies, say, between what you may have in North America versus what you would see in Africa or other parts of Asia? Is there any data that's out there on relative to peanut allergies?
Peanut allergies is principally a developed country phenomenon. A lot of places, when you say, we got, you know, do you have peanut allergies? They say, what is it? I mean, it is not on the horizon, the radar of Africa, Latin America, and Asia. It really is, it's specific to our environment, and there's a lot of concern as to why that might be. I mean, what is happening? Because it's not only peanut allergies that is increasing. If you look at the allergy stuff, all of the allergies are increasing exponentially. And the issue is what is happening in our environment that is doing that. Now, the peanut allergy is the one that everyone grabs people's attention because people die from it. But they also die from shellfish and other things. But somehow peanuts is a lightning rod for that. I mean, it's a lightning rod for aflatoxin as well. The majority of aflatoxin in exposure happens because people eat corn, not peanuts. And that's because although corn is commonly contaminated less than peanuts, people eat so much more.
We have a question from one of our webinar participants. This is from Brett Raymond at Mana Foods in Kigali, Rwanda. He asks, Dr. Williams, you stated that peanuts are often an informal industry that often does not receive Ministry of Agriculture attention. How then does Peanut Crisp support FTF programs, given that Feed the Future typically supports only official government agriculture programs?
That is for us a challenge. Out of all the Feed the Future countries, only three of them, Zambia, Malawi, Mozambique, identified peanut as something that they wanted to work to, as a focus for their effort. I think in a way it's tragic, because when you focus on these other things, the other crops, the big commodities, you actually are largely you're increasing the challenge to provide benefit for the woman. You know, this is a critically important crop for women. And if you wanted to, if governments were really serious about achieving the advancement of women, they wouldn't focus on maize, or they would have included peanut with maize. It is really important for women, and it's actually very commonly the critical cash crop at the family, the household economy. You know, that the ones that constitute that are sesame, peanut, and sometimes beans. But beans are much, not so gender biased. Peanuts is a woman's crop because it takes a lot of digging, and it's a lot of hard work. And the men would rather go and drink beer or whatever, but the women understand the importance of it.
Thank you, Dr. Williams. My name is Mike McGahee. I'm with the Natural Resource Management Office at USAID. Very rich presentation. Thank you very much. You talked about the production potential being much higher than it actually is. You said there are probably three or four key interventions that could be made to increase that productivity. And could you talk a little bit more about those, and particularly about some of the soil constraints that might be faced by increasing productivity, particularly in Africa where you have very old weathered soils? Thank you.
Okay. When I started my work in Zimbabwe, and there we were able to achieve yields of 10,000 pounds. Now, the elements of that was that we managed the foliar diseases, we exploited fully the season, we actually extended the season. Just by starting it 6 weeks before the rains, you could, if you could put some irrigation or you could get the plants up, you could actually get peanuts that would be in the ground for 6 months, and when you did that, you had a huge yield potential. But the elements are to fully utilize the season with the right choice of variety, to protect against the foliar diseases, either with fungicide sprays or with resistances. Now, when you start sowing peanuts at the beginning of the rainy season instead of 6 weeks later, you already have a huge impact, because the farmer that sows early actually has 6 weeks advantage relative to the foliar diseases. They start when the rains are there, the first rains. If you sow 6 weeks later, there's a lot of spores around as your plant comes through. Now, moving on to the soil issues, there are two elements in the soil that peanuts are more susceptible to. One is sulfur, and this is something that is a feature of was certainly the weathered granite sands of southern Africa can be an issue. And also you have the same kind of problems for the Sahelian sands. And the other one is calcium. Those two elements are the major limiting factors, or the major most commonly needed inputs. Phosphorus it's a very effective. It'll be actually recovering phosphorus when other crops have stopped. And that does this because it's got a very prolific mycorrhizal relationship with fungi. And then in terms of nitrogen, it's promiscuous with rhizobium, and it is very effective with rhizobium. In Zimbabwe, we measured 300 nitrogen fixed in a crop. Now, by the time you take away the seed and the protein, which is, and you take that off the field, you have, and you leave behind, generally speaking, between 60 and 80 pounds per acre of nitrogen. So, as a rotation, it's a really important part of it. Traditionally, it's commonly sown in intercrops, and that I don't think is really a good thing for peanuts, because you never break the cycle of foliar diseases. Here in the States, to have profitable production, we need to have a rotation cycle which is preferred to be 3 or 4 years, and that is important because it breaks that cycle of pests and diseases. Now if you're going to grow continuous peanuts, you've got to expect to put a whole lot more chemicals on it. But those are the elements. For West Africa, we can, if you sow it, the tradition is that they will sow their sorghum, maize, or whatever they do. They'll wait for 6 weeks or so. And they'll focus their efforts on weed control in the other crop. And then they will come in and they will add to that the peanut. That peanut has to be a short season variety, so you lose yield potential there. But it is also, now, if you take that peanut and you sow it after the first rains, you will go up from 800 pounds to 2,400 pounds, just that single intervention. But then you have to have the ability to when it's raining. So you've got to change variety and sowing date simultaneously.
We have a few questions about the binding agents. Joan Jennings from the TOPS program and Sam Goff from Food for the Hungry both ask about the potential future timeline for use of the binding agents for human consumption or the release for sale to the general public. And Brett Raymond from Manna Foods in Rwanda also wanted to ask if you're aware if Codex prohibits any use of binding agents in infant foods.
Well, the Codex would apply. Codex also prohibits aflatoxin in the food. And that prohibition is generally speaking worthless. That's the truth. 25% of the foods in Africa are contaminated, despite Codex. Now, when I first went down this road, I wrote to WHO, and they said, "Don't worry, we got Codex." You know, and I don't know what you do about it, but Codex is. Codex is a challenge, but Europe has changed and has accepted it. This is used, this product, it's an FDA grass substance. We can go and buy it in our health foods, and we can add it to our foods without anyone caring about it. It's safe. So the prohibition is because we're using it to bind something that is we know is harmful. It defies logic.
Joyce Turk, USAID. What is the timeline for controlling aflatoxins?
I would say that if we get all the governments on board, and there's increasing evidence that they are coming around to recognize that this is something they need to address. I would think that between 10 and 20 years is a realistic target. It takes 10 years to breed a variety. You've got to disseminate it. You've got to teach lots of other technologies. You've got to have the ability to measure it. There's a huge infrastructure that goes with this. And while people are looking to do that, I think that certainly for urban areas, much quicker, much easier because it's, but for rural areas, I would think, 10 to 20 years. Now, I'm not saying that the binding agents should replace all of that effort. I think it should be an integral part of it. The binding agents can allow people to be protected now. And I think that the price of not doing that is enormous. Contemplate the numbers of children that get aflatoxin through mother's milk. It's in placental cord blood. Children born at certain times of the year in West Africa live shorter lives. And the prime candidate for this is aflatoxin because animal studies show that there is this legacy. You expose embryonic tissue to aflatoxin, you have changed immunity out the other side. So you can impact the long-term immune competence by fecal exposure.
I'm Frida Buenge. I'm in the Bureau for Food Security. I think one of the... You can hear me? I think one of the reasons for peanuts not, you know, being taken seriously, especially in Africa, is because people don't know the uses, I mean, the many uses of like peanuts. Most people, like in Uganda, where you say they are growing lots of peanuts, they use them in like cooking with greens, and they don't use it like on like put on a bread where they know it could be a daily snack for a child. I mean, for me, I came from Africa, and I knew peanut butter could be used on bread when I came here. And up to now, I mean, people like in the villages, they don't know they can, you know, roast and crush the peanut and use it on bread and give it for their kids for, you know, like such a good nutritional, you know, food. So part of, I mean, what we could do is to, like, educate people on more uses apart from cooking it with the, you know, stews and roasting and eating, like, dry. But there are some other uses which could be more beneficial. Are there any efforts into trying to educate people on some extra benefits of peanuts?
Well, we actually do work and we spend as much effort in extending the use of peanuts for food and nutrition as we spend developing the production potential. It is really important, and by doing what you're talking about, we had over many years, we had a program in the Philippines that systematically got worked in that area. The Philippine peanut butter industry, at one stage grew 10% a year for many years. And that industry is driven by all sorts of entrepreneurial people that are taking out peanut butter. We actually had the good fortune to run a course on manufacturing peanut butter, and one of the participants from that set up a little kitchen factory, and in 2 years she was the entrepreneur of the year for the Philippines. This lady now is selling in supermarkets all over the Philippines. I mean, it is there. I've actually got a picture of a lady, and I'm pretty sure this is from Burkina Faso, but she is making peanut butter, and she has got a plank and a bottle, and she is rolling the peanut butter to produce it. The great thing about peanuts is that it's a lot of the production and the value-adding opportunities are scale-independent. You can do it with a pot on the stove. You can do it with a 1,000-ton-per-hour roaster. You know, you can get the same product both ways.
Thank you very much. Great presentation. Kathleen Kurz from DAI. I work more on the nutrition side, so I really appreciate the attention to the improvements in particularly the child nutritional status. My question is more on the price, though. As the aflatoxin issue goes away and as the uses of it go up, what do you expect relative to the price and the supply? As you know, in nutrition, one of the most important things for weaning foods is that people can afford to add the variety of nutrients that comes from a diversity of foods, including the peanuts. And I also I saw something that the price of peanuts is going up in the U.S., so it kind of prompted me to wonder about the price, the international price as well, or the local price for that matter.
Well, in a lot of countries, actually, the local price set by is equal or better than the international price. The challenge that we have in that is to balance production with demand, because it is labor intensive. If there isn't a reasonable margin on it, people don't do it. But having said that, people also tend to underestimate the value of this as a protein, as a source of energy. It is hugely, it's so energy dense. It's got twice what maize has got in terms of calories, and it's got four times the protein. And it's got, sort of good levels of folic acid and many of those things in it. So it's in that sense, it's good value food. To some extent, getting people to understand the value of it is important.
Paul Bundick, FHI, Family Health International. Thank you very much for the good presentation. I was wondering a couple things about, you mentioned on post-harvest, reduction through better post-harvest techniques. How much contamination is transferred through handling of the shell of the nut? Because I've heard that aflatoxin grows on the shell of the peanut, and it can kind of infect through handling. And are there any low-cost detection devices which can be applied to sort good or infected contaminated peanuts from uncontaminated peanuts? And whether contaminated peanuts can be pressed into oil? In fact, I've heard that, I don't know if it's true, but the toxin does not transfer as well through into oil as it does into meal.
Okay, many questions there. The toxin is produced by a fungus which grows. The stuff that's in the shell is the main hazard for that is for people that are actually working in silos or something like that. They can actually get the toxin in particular form, and they can breathe it in and absorb it that way. It's the key to managing this is to stop the fungus growing, so that if you keep it dry, you're not going to have that as a problem. One of the biggest problems is where you actually have humid environments. It'll absorb water out of the atmosphere and get into that half-dry status, and in that's when this is a competitive fungus. It's not competitive when it's wet, and it's not competitive, it doesn't grow when it's dry, but it outcompetes other fungi in that region between, say, 12% moisture and 18% moisture. Above that, it's not an issue. The second part. Detection. It fluoresces, so in theory you can use dark light and find things, but lots of things fluoresce, so that you can't be sure on that. We spend a lot of time training industries and working with industries, teaching them how to identify what is potentially dangerous, remove it. We have factories that we've worked with where over 5 years they have never had anything more than this very lowest levels of detection, one part per billion, as a result of just hand sorting. If you sort, you can remove it pretty effectively. The most effective sorting comes when you actually blanch it. So if you get the skin off it, then remove any discolor, you've got it. So, there's lots of things. One of the biggest problems is in terms of when you start sorting, people will put that aside and someone else will come and buy what's been sorted out because they're food insecure and they figure that it's, you know, it's not going to kill you. And it doesn't kill you today, it kills you down the road. So, you know, that there is no immediate connection between this dangerous practice and a consequence that is a deferred thing, and that is why it is so dangerous.
Hi, my name is Megan Murphy. I'm with the QED group, and thank you very much for your presentation. I really appreciated the way you spoke to the multi-sectoral benefits and uses of peanuts from the agricultural, from the health and nutrition. As development practitioners, we're often very siloed in the way that we approach these problems, and it seems like one of the things the CRISP has been very successful at doing is bridging some of those sectoral gaps in the way you do your work. And I wondered if you could speak to this a little bit and some of the challenges and ways that you've overcome them and maybe some of the lessons you might have for others doing this kind of work.
Well, there are lots of frustrations in trying to do this work. I mean, to me, it seems really obvious that something that is of potential significance to world health as immune suppression associated with this toxin would be absorbed and become something around which multiple parts of USAID and NIH could get around. But when we go out and we try and work with that, we go to NIH and we go to the health pillar here, in you know, this is an ag problem. In actual fact, our really big breakthrough came when we persuaded the ag people to allow us to go into that area. And from that, we've actually, we realized that we had technologies, you know, all of those technologies that I showed, we had those available, but we could never get anyone to adopt it because there was no economic incentive. You know, when you're going to sell your peanuts, whether they're moldy or not, why do anything different? Why invest time and effort taking out the bad ones? Because that's what lost. That's lost to you. Coming back very quickly, you can express oil out of it. You just got to clean it up, and there are ways that. And the majority of peanut oil in the USA comes from lower classes of peanuts that they just take it, squeeze the oil out, and put it through. You can actually use the bentonite technologies just to actually clean up that oil. You'll put it in the sunlight and it'll destroy it. You know, UV will destroy it. There's lots of things that will destroy it. But anyway, coming back now to the challenge of working between the stovepipes. Our real breakthrough came through when they said, yeah, we could go out and we persuaded. It was Emmy Simmons was in charge here at that time, and Ron Brown. He got to understand what the opportunity was. I mean, when I first started into this area, I looked at it and I said, oh, we've got this product that will absorb it, and I thought it should be an absolute cinch. Just add this to the food, and we were going to fix all the cancers. But when I actually realized that it wasn't, the cancer is the least of the issue. You know, 43% of the burden of disease is modulated by immunity or nutrition. The top seven world health risks are all changed by aflatoxin. Then you start saying, wow, this is a huge problem. And that argument sort of was where the USAID Ag Bureau stock. And from that, they actually gave us money that we have done to document, use to document as well as we can with the resources we have, the health consequences of neglecting this. And they are huge. You know, a lot of this is correlative, but you can find or you can go to animals and you can duplicate what you see in humans. It's already done for animals. It's aflatoxin suppresses immunity causally with animals. And it's correlated, high aflatoxin, low immunity in humans. Vitamin A, zinc, then maternal effects that I've shown in animals. And you see on a correlative basis, you see in a cross-sectional study, you'll see the same things in humans. I think it's really frustrating and that people are locked in their stovepipes. And it's a stovepipe. It's not a glass tower that they're looking out to see what's out there. They're not looking out.
Okay, with that, I'd like to thank Tim for joining us today, giving us an excellent talk about the peanut crisp. I'd like to thank our audience, both in person and online, for joining us. For those in person, there are evaluations that were on your chair. If you could please fill those out and hand them back to us, we greatly appreciate your feedback on how to make these sessions better. For those online, we'll be sending you a link that you can use to fill out an evaluation, and please send those back to us too. Again, November 30th will be our next Ag Sector Council, so please join us for that. Also, we'll send all those who RSVP'd a notice when the presentation has been turned into what we call a screencast, so the audio synced with the PowerPoint and goes up online, and so you can refer back to it and send it around to friends and colleagues in your network. Also, if you go to AgriLinks and go to the events page for our talk today, there's the ability to post comments. So I encourage you to do that if you have questions that have come up that you didn't have a chance to get answered here, so to continue the conversation. So with that, please pay attention to AgriLinks, join AgriLinks, and look forward to the next session. All right, thank you very much. Have a good day.